The question is, what consciousness is used when humans access intuition? We have to define what intuition means. I think intuition is something in your mind that you naturally respond to it. Actually, this word intuition is very difficult to define. But I think your questions, if I rephrase it, what consciousness, how do you think when you produce an intuition? Is that what you mean from David? Can you clarify what you mean?
Sure.
Yeah, that's what you mean, right? That's what you mean. So when you think about something from within, intuition from within, this intuition, of course, lies not just at the surface level. When it's called intuition, it must be at a little deeper level, maybe at a subliminal level. At a lower level, how do you access it? What consciousness is used? This is a very general question. Well, to talk about this, it encompasses a whole course of Buddhist phenomenology. In other words, the school of the consciousness only, or the Vijnanavadin school. Or in the Japanese call it Hosso, H-O-S-S-O, Hosso, Hosso school. The Chinese sometimes call it Fa Xiang Zhong, Dharma characteristic school. It means all characteristic school. So what is consciousness? Do we have only one consciousness? We have eight consciousnesses that we're talking about. Every time when we talk about these eight consciousnesses, we always start with the salesman first at the front door, the sense, the ear consciousness, the nose, the eye, the ear. We start at the front end and then we'll work towards the subliminal level. But now this time I want it to be a little different. I want to start from the subliminal level first. Our consciousness at a very subliminal level, a very deep level, is the Alaya consciousness. Associated with it is the manas consciousness. The alaya consciousness is the store consciousness, which store all your past from beginninglessness, we don't know when. Billions of lives ago, many, many reincarnations ago, it accumulates all the archives, it accumulates all the impressions, dispositions, activities, what every thought, every action, every deed, wholesome, unwholesome, neutral, mental defilements, they all store in the alaya consciousness. It's like an ocean, it's immeasurable ocean. How many megabytes? I don't know. Uncountable. It's always in there. That ocean can store everything in it. And this ocean by itself, it has the nature of being neutral. Means it absorbs wholesome, unwholesome, everything in it without judging it. No. And some people say no, because it received wholesome, that means it has a wholesome characteristic in it. No, it has a neutral characteristic. It accepts everything, it stores everything. And whatever it stores becomes seeds. Now seeds is a metaphorical, have a metaphorical sense. Seeds, that means energy, the potential energy hidden in it. Now these seeds hidden in alaya consciousness. So whenever I see something, I hear something, I touch something, this alaya consciousness interacts simultaneously with all the other consciousnesses. Not temporally in a sequence, no. It interacts at the same time simultaneously. It's a very important concept. In other words, when you see something, it does not mean that, oh, seeing and then transmitting and then getting to the interlevel and the lower level, they correspond, interact in tandem with it simultaneously. So that means all these past experiences, when you see something through your doors, through the sense of consciousness, simultaneously interact and simultaneously transform the image into your consciousness. Now that is the first subjective transformation. Why do we call it subjective? Because you sensed it. Because you see it with your own past experiences. With whatever happened in your past. If you see it with your past karma, with your past experiences, that means you see it with color lenses already. It's subjective. It's called subjective is because not everybody is the same. You see this ball, and I see this ball, this is the ball, but because of your subjective alaya consciousness and my subjective alaya consciousness, it is a ball. The common karmic attribution is a ball, but you perceive it and I perceive it a little differently. At the crude level, it's the same, it's a ball. But at the very subtle level, which is the most important, it's not just a ball. Why you and I see it as a ball and not a piece of nugget, gold nugget? Why? Because our karma has a common karma and a specific karma. In other words, what is common karma? I'm getting into very details, but anyway, I don't mind. I don't feel comfortable if I don't get into detail. Because I'm just touching the surface. I'm just playing around. What is common karma and specific karma? We come to this world, we must have some common characteristics in our alaya consciousness that make us come back together in here. Otherwise, I'll be in heaven and you'll be maybe in here. I'm in heaven because my karma is not yours. You and I, we must have some common karma that we enjoy the same hospital, Richmond Hospital, enjoy the same safe way, we enjoy the same medical help, we enjoy the same roads, the same parking lot, or maybe all this is common. But then, within the common, there is specific karma. You are living in Shaughnessy, and I'm living in an old house. I'm not even living in the whole house. I rented a single bachelor apartment, and it's terrible. I only got one room, and you have a whole mansion. Your house is worth $6 million, and my apartment, every month, I have to pay $600 rent. I have to lift my mouth to work. I can't even support all the means. Why? I am enjoying the same hospital as you do. I'm walking the same road. It says that I'm seeing this as a bowl, the same bowl. But somehow your karma and my karma is different. You subjectively transform this and you don't know about it. And let me give you another example. A pool of water. When ghost realm sentient beings see the pool of water, it's not crystal clear water, it's blood. So when they want to drink something, you may see it as water you're giving them to drink, they see it as pus and blood. When they drink it, they can't drink it. When the heavenly sentient beings see a pond of clear water, it's crystal, they can walk on it. When the fish see water, it's their habitat, it's their palace, it's their apartment, their house. So in other words, in each realm, it's the same pond of water, but because their karma are different, they interact, they see it, they even get close to it with a different specific purpose. So actually, whatever you see, you think that's really what it is? It appears as what it is? No. You already transform it into what you believe what it is. So there's your first subjective transformation. That's your alaya consciousness. Whatever you see, because your karma and my karma are different, you see it with your own lenses. And I see it with my lenses. Are our lenses the same? No. The crude level is the same. The specific level is not the same. When I see a beautiful willow tree, I admire the beauty of the willow. I like nature. I like even the sound it produces. when there's another guy who sees this willow tree, gee, I'm going to chop it down. It's terrible. I don't like willow trees. He's going to chop it down. It's not the same. And why? When I see as a monk, when I see a beautiful lady, a sensuous lady walking by, and I may not have any thought in it. Whereas another sensuous fellow says, oh my goodness. You know what I mean? They have different idea of what it's all about. It's the same object. It's the same object with different karma. You see, the first subjective transformation is the alaya consciousness. Simultaneously at the same time. You don't know about it because it's at the surface level, that's the ball. At a subliminal level, you don't even know it. If you start to be conscious of your alaya consciousness, you're on your way to enlightenment. Because you are conscious of what you're doing. You're conscious this is not what you should not do, this is what you should do. That's the first subjective transformation. The second subjective transformation is what? It's your manas, M-A-N-A-S. That's the seventh consciousness. That's the ego consciousness. The part of your mind, there's a region in which you always identify yourself as I. It's a self-centered I. And this I views the alaya consciousness as an object and mistakenly perceive it as permanent. Attaches to the alaya consciousness. This is the manas consciousness, the I, the ego consciousness. At simultaneously, at the same time, it is created when all the other consciousness interact with the outside world. There's a second subjective transformation. In other words, other than the first subjective transformation of differentiating, I also identify myself centered with this. I'm going to get this. This is mine. This is yours. You're not going to get my personal interest. This is my bank account. This is yours. This is my brother. This is your brother. You're not going to hit my brother. If you hit my brother, I'll revenge. You have a lot of this I, ego in you, which is the second subjective transformation. What is the third subjective transformation? All subjective. Nothing is objective. Why? Why is everything subjective? Because you see it with your own karma, and no karma is objectively the same. What is the third subjective transformation? That is your mano consciousness, your thinking consciousness. And that contains a lot of afflictions at the end. The primary afflictions of craving, ill will, ignorance, self-conceit, dope, view of a composite self, extreme view, perverse view, attachment to one's views, anger, hatred, jealousy. You name them. 51 of them. This mano consciousness interact with, we call it the mind king, the consciousness king, interact with 51 ministers, interact with the minister of envy, the minister of ignorance, the minister of doubt, the minister of anger, the minister of hatred, the minister of jealousy, the minister of conceit. They interact with these ministers and carry out all these activities. So if you ask me what consciousness is used, you just simultaneously interact with it, interact to it. And you're not aware of it. You don't even aware of this subjective transformation. You have your personal view on it. You're not aware of it. And especially the ego consciousness. Because the alaya consciousness is neutral, it accepts everything. What differentiates it is the ego consciousness. And that ego consciousness have emphasis on self-deceit, self-love, self-craving, and self-arrogance, all contained in it. Now, that explains consciousness already in just a few words. How to make us realize our mano consciousness just to know about it, just to understand it. How do the Buddha's teaching make us be aware of all these mental afflictions? How to curb it? The Buddha introduced the six paramitas, remember? One of the six paramitas, the first one is giving. Giving is it's the forerunner of it because it's easier to practice. And if you practice giving all the time, you are in the process of eliminating your ego because what you own, you give out. That's why we have people who donate for lunch. Well, when I sit down for lunch, you give it to me free, I just accept it. But when you come to think of it, oh, this lunch, somebody prepared it. If I go to a restaurant, I got to pay for it, and I'm not comfortable when I accept some people's paying for me. You know, I really want to donate, I want to give it back. Then you consider the first moment that you consider giving is the moment when you eliminate, when you start to realize your own ego. I want to give. I don't want just to receive. Because you want to possess it. The possessiveness is the ego. You want to give it out as much as you can. And the sutra says that why do we have a world in which there is the poor and the very rich? The very rich, in the Alaya consciousness, they have already accumulated all this karma that make them be rich. In their previous life, for many, many lives, they already have, they're very generous. They give out a lot. I remember just about 2 years ago, I met a monk in Hong Kong, a senior monk, and we have a conversation. Just about a year and a half ago, we had a conversation. He's a very senior monk, about 85, and he's been a monk for 65 years. I don't know if he has supernatural power. He won't tell me anyway. And nobody should tell anybody supernatural power. And I said, I started this temple 30 years ago. Now it's 32 years. And I started this temple with a piece of dirt. At that time, I was not a monk. I was just a layman. And somehow, in this 30 years, it seems that I have no problems in getting donations. The donations just find its way to come to me. And you think it's easy? Would people just give you money to build a temple? I said, I don't understand. Because there's so many other people who try to build a temple and they never get successful in doing it. Who would give you millions of dollars to build, to buy land, to give you all? I don't know why people are so willing, directly or indirectly, they donate and they donate in kinds and all that. And I have someone who I talk to them for about half an hour and they donate hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the monk said, there's a reason for it, my friend. He called me my friend. Think about what you did in this lifetime, me. And think about what you could have done in your previous life. I said, I don't know anything about previous lives, but think about what you did in your early childhood. Did you give anything out? Giving anything out? No, I came from a poor family. What did I have to give out? And then, maybe something happened to me when I was about 13 years old. Because when I had to go to school in the morning, I always had to take the ferry to Central District, from Kowloon to Central District, I have to take a ferry. And my mom gave me $3.50. That included my lunch, my transportation, and everything in there. A meager allowance. And so I have $3.50 in my pocket. And one morning I was on a ferry, I hurried through of my homework that I haven't finished last night, listening to radio. I was very busy finishing my homework. And then I saw this monk going from one aisle to another, taking out a bowl to beg for money. Nobody give anything. There's 200 people on the ship. It's open space, you know, you can actually see the ocean, all the wind, very windy, and he's getting a bowl, you know, from aisle to aisle and trying to collect some alms round, some money. And in my little mind, I was thinking, oh, this monk, did he come from mainland China? Where is he going? Nobody gives him any money. And does he have enough transportation fee to go to his destination? I was worrying for him. I was only 13 years old. I was worrying for him. Nobody wanted to give him any money. So even though nobody gave him any money, he put up a smiling face, and I still remember he got two teeth locked off from here, no teeth in here. When he was smiling, there's a hole in here. I still remember it. So it was, you know, doing this, and there's got a hole in here, and going from aisle to aisle, from person to person. Nobody even paid attention to him. I was thinking, gee, it's quite sad that nobody gives me any donation. And what I did is, without questioning what I should do, I took out the 350 when it came to me and put it all in his bowl. 350. That's my lunch. That's my return fare. Everything is in there. I didn't even think, what am I going to do without any money? So when I come to think, oh, maybe that's the donation, my first donation. That's it, my friend, because you gave out unconditionally, not even considering yourself. You give everything out. You're so compassionate. You are slowly getting the return. And I'll tell you, in the future, you will continue to have that. Plus, I suspect that in your previous life, you must have given out a lot. This is what he told me. I don't know if he has that supernatural power to have seen my previous life. But it seems that, yes, I never value money for myself. I always treasure old stuff. In other words, a pair of pants, I become so attached to it that I don't want to throw it away. Because I like it so much, it's all worn out, but I still like it. Even my underwear, it's all broken. But I like it so much. It's so you build up a certain history to it. You have a historical record of it, you don't want to get rid of it. So I don't even buy anything. I don't buy anything. I don't go out. I don't go out to buy anything. I never go shopping. People are a lot of shopping. I never go out shopping. So giving is the first to get rid of your ego. And the more you give out, the more it bounces back to you. Maybe that's why it's bouncing back to me. But when it bounces back to me, I give it out again. It's all in the temple. And when people come to the temple, and he always said, 1 year ago when I came here, it's not the same. It seems that for all these years that I come here, every year is different. You're always in the process of developing it. Yes, I started from a piece of land, about a half an acre. Now it's 12 acres. I started with a stature of stature and a foundation sum of approximately $300,000, and now it's worth, I don't know. I don't even give a dollar value to it, because I know the other temple on number 5, just a building, 20 million. Just a building, 20 million. And how many buildings we've got in here? But I'm poor. I don't have, this money don't belong to me. It's all belong to the temple. So every cost has an effect to it. So you have to learn to give out. Give out as much as you can. If you want to see return, it always comes back to you. But you don't give out conditionally. That's what the Diamond Sutra says. If you give it out to you unconditionally, it will come back in many thousands of fold. But if you give out conditionally, it will still come back, but the merit is not as much. I have a friend who, 20 years ago, he started a program of helping needy school children to have education in China. And he has been doing that for many years, 20 years. And I have also friends who don't care about donating to educate poor kids, give them the education, give them the lunches and all that. But this guy has been doing it for 20 years. I think he spent a total of maybe $1 million. He's not that rich, but he always helped out the poor children. And I know that all his children, they're all highly educated. No problem with the children's schooling, no problem with education. They're always top-notch students. Whereas for some people who are rich people, they don't care about that kind of donations. Their kids, they can't finish universities. They become, they're not educated. Even they are educated, but their kids are not educated. Somehow, you educate the other kids, your kids get the same return, the same attention. There's always cause and effect. We call it causality. So make every thought, every action, every word, there is an effect to it. Be careful with it. Don't misuse it. So the first to learn is to give out. Now, I'm glad that we all, we all learn to do that. It's very important to give out. Say, for example, our lunches are free. We never ask for donations. But we should always consider how come people are so generous in giving out and some people are not. You see the difference. The difference will be in what you encounter in the future. It all comes back to you. Okay, next question. What are some different ways of dissolving the negative seeds in the Alaya consciousness? In order to deal with, you cannot dissolve it, you can only dilute it. Because it's already been polluted, you can dilute it. You learn the Buddhist teaching. You have to study what happened to your mind. What is the structure of mind, how your mind thinks, how you cognize things. And how do you change your cognition? How do you transform your three subjective transformations into purity? Then you have to do it stage by stage. So how do you dissolve negative seeds? The right actions, the right livelihood, the right view. You have to learn all that. I can't tell you in just one sitting in here. You have to learn all that to make it come true. If you want to further study Buddhism, you don't view Buddhism as a superstitious religion. It's about the mind. You have to study your cognitions. How do you cognize an object? How is mental afflictions being created? You have to study, you have to map out your mind to trace it and know how you think, and then you start at the source of your thinking. By starting at the origin, then you can curb all the poisons. You don't try to cut the branches only. You got to cure the roots at the root level, not at the branches level. So you really have to understand the religion. And the religion contains so much thinking in it that it's like an ocean. And people classify it into 8 schools. And one of the schools is consciousness school. Which studies the mind in detail. And some people, and it is also called a Yogacara school. Now, if you want to understand the religion, the Buddhist teaching scientifically, you cannot but spend a lot of time in the Yogacara. Because that's how analytically it analyzes the mind. And if you want to sit and debate for the Buddhist teaching, to support the Buddhist teaching, you really have to understand the Yogacara school. But the Yogacara school is very difficult to understand. Because if you read the Chinese language, it's written in ancient Chinese, and it's very abbreviated. But more and more, there are English translations of it that you can study. One of the books that you can study is the Buddhist Phenomenology or any books regarding Yogacara school. That if you understand that, the 8 minds, the study of the 8 minds and in detail, people, if you study the Chinese version, one has to spend at least 10, 15 years to master the teaching. But for some people, they master it in 2-3 years. They have learned it in their previous life. They master it in 2-3 years. It's just like learning piano. Some people in this life, they don't learn. They just remember. You don't start to learn in this life. It just starts to come back to you. You remember it. It's just like Johnny playing piano at 5 years old, playing Mozart. Why? He didn't learn it this life. He's just slowly being revived, his memories being revived. And as he plays on, all his talents hidden in this, in Alaya consciousness, in this, all the seeds come back. All the seeds get blossom. And all of a sudden, he remembers all these musical pieces. That happened in quite a few families like that, right? You nod a few times. That means you heard about that too, right?
George Gershwin, for example.
George what?
George Gershwin, the famous American composer.
Yeah.
And they bought a piano for his older brother.
Yeah.
Who was the lyricist up the writing pair. As they're moving the piano into the house, George is already on the piano playing. Never had a lesson.
See? Yeah. And he wrote out his lyrics for him?
Yeah.
There are many cases like that. Yeah, Mozart at 4 years old.
Everything he wrote just one time. It just came out of his head. Perfect on the paper. He never rewrote anything.
Yeah.
Just wrote it once.
So if that is not from previous life, what is it from? If it's not from the archives. So you believe in the archives? You just got to dig it out from your files. You go to the archive files and put it out and dig it out and say, here's Mozart. Yeah. Yeah.
To give a name to it.
Some people call it intuition. Some people call it the subconsciousness, the subliminal thinking. But the Buddhist teaching analyze it in detail, more detail than any other Western philosophy. Because I study Western philosophies, but it's in very much detail. Sometimes it scares people away because you get into that much detail. I can't remember all the terms, but it gets into details. And previous life learning, reviving it in this life, a lot of cases like that. So it must be from the archives. Particularly for children, because they haven't got any confusion and conflicts yet in life. As you move on to maturity, you have a lot of pollutants that, in other words, you don't get to the archive file so early, you get to archive file late, all these keys get rusty. You can't open the files anymore. So you have to lubricate all these again. And for the youngsters, they don't need to because they're still fresh in their mind. So when you want to learn the Buddhist teaching, you should learn it at a young age, not when you're too old. At young age, you discover more. There are many musicians, belong to that category. And also a scientist too. Scientists and artists. A lot of artists are like that. Yes?
In the Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra, it says at the end, this is the great, bright, unsurpassed.
Yeah.
It's greater than all.
Yeah.
Could you explain that? How that mantra is deemed to be greater than all other mantras?
I think in most dharani it says, "Oh, it's the greatest. It's better than all." It's just an emphasis on it. I think they are equal. Greater than all. That means to draw your attention. That don't ignore this. Greater than all in the perspective that if you dig deeper and deeper into it, is the greatest. In almost all dharani, it says that it's the greater than all, dig deep into it. Gatte, gatte, prakatte, brasamgatte, buddhiswaha. That means if you dig deeper and deeper into the crust of the earth, you get the oil. And oils are the same. You get different locations, different mantras, different locations. And every mantra, every location says, dig deep. Go more, more, more. If you go more, you get the greatest. This sutra says, go more, you get the greatest. But the petroleum is the same. It depends on how deep you dip into it, you dig into it. So it always reminds you that go, gade, go, paragade, go beyond, prasamgade, beyond, go more, buddhiswaha. When you do that, you get the oil. When I chant the Buddha medicine, Namo Bhagavate Vaisaji Guru Rai Duraya, I find that if I chant it 21 times, it doesn't come to me to be in tranquility. When I chant 108 times and up to about 90, then I start to be like myself in the middle of the chanting with no distraction. It takes, why do we chant so many times? Every time you chant just 3 times on a bus, you can never get into the trance. You can never get into the inner crust of it. So you have to get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. Then all of a sudden there's an illumination. You can't get it just for 3 times. Some people said, every day I chant it 7 times. You don't get it for 7 times. 108 times, it's a very good way of digging deeper and deeper. And I know youngsters, Korean youngsters, who chant thousands of times per day. And I think he bow 1,000 times per day. Is it 1,000 times?
1,000 times a day, 49 days in a row.
49 days, every day he bow 1,000 times for 49 days. And he had to still go to school, right? He got up 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, what a kid. It's about, what a kid. It's 15 years old, right? 15 years old. He's in a Korean temple in Surrey. And every day, 1,000 prostrations for 49 days. Yeah. See, everyone is different. But when you really practice that, the Zen master, Xu Yun, empty cloud, have you heard of empty cloud, the Zen master? He make a pilgrimage to a mountain and make a vow for his mom. All the merits attribute to my mom, that is what he said in front of the Buddha. The pilgrimage is every three steps, one prostration. He traveled from one province to another, and that took 3 years. Even in the winter time, he carried on. He carried on in a slope, because if you go further, that means you're losing one prostration. Every two steps, he go back again for one prostration in order not to cheat. You know what? You understand what I mean? It is in the slope. So he make one prostration for 3 steps, and he walked for 3 years. He walked for 3 years, and in at least 2 instances, he passed out. One in a mountain, in a snow mountain, and he got saved by a beggar. And this beggar, and he asked for the name of the beggar, and just call me Man. And the beggar said, I don't have a name, just call me Man. And that's Manjushri. And he passed out 2 times. He was saved by the same beggar. It was all in the autobiography. And when he got to the mountain destination, he asked, have you ever seen a beggar by the name Man? No, we never have that beggar around in here. And one of the monks said, oh, that's Manjushri, Bodhisattva, who saved you while you were in difficulties. He was saved at least 2 times in the autobiography. One, he passed out in the snow. Another time, he had no food. And he passed out again, and he was brought into a hut by this beggar. So there are stories like that.